Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Michael Lacona, an associate professor in theology at Houston Baptist University, who earned his PhD in New Testament Studies at the University of Pretoria. He is the author of several books, including The Case for the Real Jesus, The Resurrection of Jesus, A New Historiographical Approach, Paul Meets Muhammad, and The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus, which he co-authored with Gary Habermas. Mike is a member of the Evangelical Philosophical Society, the Institute for Biblical Research, and the Society for Biblical Literature. He has spoken on more than 50 university campuses, runs his own website ministry called Risen Jesus, and has appeared on dozens of radio and television programs. But nothing compares now to making it to the growing list of guests we have on Research on Religion, 275 guests plus, so please check out our archives. If you want to learn more about Professor Lacona, we'll put up links to his books and websites, which include numerous video discussions that you all might find useful. Find these at our website and on our Facebook and Twitter feeds. Mike, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony. Good to be with you.
Okay, so here we are. We're a week away from Easter, when Christians all around the world celebrate the resurrection of Jesus Christ. They put on their Sunday finest and they go fill the pews. It's one of the more popular holidays to be in church. Afterwards, there's probably going to be some egg hunts and some ham dinners. The celebration of Easter has become rather ritualistic, but the question that I have is, what do we really know about the veracity of Jesus' resurrection, other than that's what we were told to believe when we were in Sunday school? That's going to be our topic of discussion today. I want to first start out, though, by asking you personally, how did you come to write a couple books about the historical evidence for the resurrection?
Well, when I was in graduate school, my last semester, I was studying New Testament. That was my, I was doing a Master of Arts in New Testament Studies. And I had been a Christian since the age of 10, and here I was in my, I guess, my mid-20s at that point. And I just started asking myself, how do I know this stuff's really true? If it's not, I'm devoting my life to a fairy tale. And I started to have questions about my faith. It wasn't anything, objections anybody had raised. I was just wondering myself, how do I know that this is true? And I thought I had a relationship with Christ, but you know, I thought I had answered prayers and so forth. But I had to admit that there are people in other religious beliefs who think that their religion is true, and they have feelings that that religion is true. And could it be that I was brought up a Christian, and that's why I'm convinced Christianity is true, rather than that's because it's really true? So I went to Gary Habermas, one of my roommates, who is working on a master's degree in philosophy, had told me about Gary Habermas and said he was very approachable, and I should talk to him about it. So he told me about the resurrection of Jesus and saying, look, Jesus himself gave his resurrection as a sign that what he predicted his resurrection, saying his resurrection would be a sign to show that what he was claiming about himself was true. So if Jesus did not rise from the dead, he was a false prophet. If he rose from the dead, then it's most likely that what he claimed about himself and about God were true. And so if everything stands or falls on the resurrection, that might be a good topic to look into. And of course, Gary is just probably the best scholar in the world on that topic. He's just studied it for decades. And so we talked about it a little bit there, and that's what got me interested in this topic.
Now, it's rather interesting that you're in seminary or in theology school, and that's, you know, you're really focusing on the ideas and beliefs and stuff, and here you start thinking about, okay, what is the empirical case for this? You're almost going to become an archaeologist or a historian here. Did some people look at you and go, hey, you know, you're supposed to be a theologian. What's all this empirical stuff? You should be taking this on faith, Mike. What's the deal?
Yeah. Well, Yeah, a lot of people would say, you know, you should just take it on faith. But if they go back to the Gospels and they read them a little more carefully, they'll find that even the disciples didn't take everything on faith. None of them, with the possible exception of the beloved disciple in John's Gospel, none of them, except possibly that disciple, accepted that Jesus had risen from the dead based on the testimony of the women who said that they'd visited the tomb, it was empty, the angels announced that Jesus had been raised from the dead, and in spite of the fact that Jesus had predicted his death and resurrection on numerous occasions. They all had to see him before they believed. It wasn't just doubting Thomas. It was all of them. So, now, he didn't praise them. He upbraided Thomas and said, you know, Thomas, you've seen and believed. Blessed are those who haven't seen and yet believe. Actually, he didn't scold Thomas for that. He just said, you know, more blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. So, you know, he didn't really put down his disciples for not believing apart from seeing him. I wanted some evidence too. And when you look at the apostolic preaching in the book of Acts, they would come out and say that the resurrection is evidence that Jesus was who he claimed to be. They cite his miracles, they cite his resurrection, and then they say that they were eyewitnesses to these things. So the people to whom they were preaching could actually see and interview the eyewitnesses who said they had seen Jesus. We don't have that luxury today. So what we have today is a book that was written 2,000 years ago, at least when we're talking about the New Testament, 27 books and letters written 2,000 years ago by no less than 9 authors, whom we've never met, we'll never be able to meet, at least in this life, and, you know, we're just supposed to trust them. Well, why not trust the Quran? Why not trust the Book of Mormon? Why not trust the Bhagavad Gita? You know, so we'd like to have evidence, and I think it's reasonable to ask for that. You know, John the Baptist, when he was in prison, he sent 2 disciples to Jesus, and he said, are you the one, the Messiah, or are we to expect someone else? And, you know, John the Baptist had the testimony of his mother, Elizabeth, about his phenomenal birth account, who also was a relative of Mary and knew about Mary's phenomenal birth account. John the Baptist had baptized Jesus, and so he had believed these things, but now he was doubting. And what did Jesus do? He told John's disciple to go back, and he says, go back and tell John what you have seen and heard. The blind see, the deaf hear, the lame walk, the dead are raised, the gospel is preached to the poor, and blessed are those who do not stumble on account of me. So he actually provided evidence for John. And then after the disciples left, here you've got a potentially embarrassing situation because Jesus' right-hand man was doubting publicly, in a sense. And Jesus did not put John the Baptist down. He said to all the people around, he said, when you came out into the wilderness to see John, who did you come out to see? Did you come out to see a reed blown back and forth by the wind? He knew John was doubting. He says, no. Did you come to see a man dressed in fine clothing? No, you got to go into a king's palace to see that. Now, let me tell you who you came out to see, a prophet, a great prophet. And no one has been born of woman who's greater than John the Baptist. So even while John was doubting, when he did that, he didn't condemn John, he didn't chide him. He gave him evidence, and he praised him. So if God doesn't get mad, if Jesus didn't get mad at John the Baptist for doubting, I don't think he gets mad at us as well. I don't think we need to have a blind faith. It's an informed faith. It's a reasonable faith based on evidence. And this is the way the apostles taught.
So that's interesting that we're prompted to have an informed faith, and I like how you put that. Not a blind faith, but an informed faith. And for us now, some 1900, 2000 years off into the future, trying to find that evidence or to reconstruct some of this evidence is going to be a little bit more difficult. The disciples, they could pull out their magnifying glasses right there and take a look. But What about us? What about you specifically when you said, okay, I'm going to go on this empirical journey to find out, to get an informed faith? What kind of evidence are you looking for? Are you just going to look for testimony? Are you going to try to dig up archaeological evidence, maybe looking for the 30 silver coins of Judas? Or what are you looking for?
Well, it's going to be documentary evidence. You can't really expect to find archaeological evidence. I mean, the only archaeological evidence you might expect to find would be an empty tomb, and it's empty, so it's not really archaeological evidence. The only thing that you could look at archaeologically that might prove the resurrection would be, say, the bones of Jesus. And you'd have to be able to somehow verify that it was actually, they were actually his bones. Or, as some have tried, to show that you have the ossuary or burial box of Jesus' bones. But those have been shown not to be his, and really hardly, you might have just a handful of people who even suggested that they were. So we're looking at documentary evidence, and then you have to look at the documents, you know, or the actual sources, the literature, to assess it for how credible it is, how early it goes, who the author might have been, were they in a position to know, do we have reason to believe the testimony, are there alternative hypotheses that better explain the data than, let's say, the resurrection hypothesis.
Now you're talking my language, alternative hypotheses, being that I'm a social scientist here, and so that's kind of neat. Was it an interesting methodological journey for you as a theologian to start digging into historiographical and documentary evidence? Did it come naturally, or did you have to do a little bit of outside training to figure out, you know, how would a historian do this?
Well, my doctoral work, my PhD is in New Testament studies, so that involves both theology and it involves history. And so the two aren't necessarily incompatible. I mean, a person can get a degree in theology, and that's all they study, the different theological doctrines and maybe how they came to be. The person could focus on history, and that's what I did. I do some work in theology, but not a whole lot. Most of my work is in history, philosophy of history, historical method, and applying it to Jesus. So, Yeah, that's what I do.
So you're right there. And that helps to alleviate some of the stereotypes or misconceptions that people have of those who go into a theological school. They think it's just all high-minded ideas. There is a lot of this history stuff, as you mentioned. We've had guests before, Jim Papandrea, one of my favorites, who has done a lot of this stuff as well. So we'll lead folks back to some of that, some of those podcasts as well. In terms of the documentary evidence, We obviously have the New Testament. We have the Gospels. That's all written down. We have Paul's letters, the epistles, and that. Are there any other sources that we have that maybe extra biblical documents? Because, you know, writing literacy was not that big at that point in time. I'm not sure how much stuff was written at that time, and I'm not sure how much other stuff was written about the events that surrounded the resurrection. Give us a sense for what we're looking at in terms of the documentary evidence.
Yeah, okay. Well, like you said, there's a lot of things in that literature of that period that has not survived. And that's not just Christian, it's Roman, it's Greek, and all that. So, for example, Plutarch, much of what we know about the ancient world comes from Plutarch. He wrote over 60 biographies, of which 50 have survived. And of the 12, you know, we're missing a biography of Caesar Augustus. That'd be wonderful to have that. But we're missing that. We're missing a bunch of what Tacitus wrote. We're just missing a lot. We're missing in the Christian literature. We know that Paul wrote two more letters to the church at Corinth that we're missing. He wrote a letter to the church at Laodicea that we're missing. You know, Papias was an early church father who most likely knew the Apostle John, and he wrote five discourses of the Lord, five volumes of the discourses of Jesus, and they have all perished. It'd be wonderful to have those. The only things we have that survived are some fragments of those, that of discourses that have been preserved in the writings of other early church fathers. So there's a lot that we are missing that we wish we had, and it's not just, like I said, not unique just to the Christians, but it applies to the Greeks, the Romans, all of them. The kind of stuff that we might find in non-Christian sources, our first non-Christian source would be probably Josephus. He mentions Jesus on two occasions. The first occasion is one that is questionable. Most scholars do not question whether Josephus mentions Jesus here. It's just, did Josephus mention all that is in the text about him in Josephus in a particular passage? In other words, it's strongly suspected that a Christian doctored up that particular text, probably in the second century. So what Josephus scholars try to do is they look at it and say, well, what part of this is probably the Christian doctoring it up? And then they excise that from the text, down, tone down text, to the text that they think was what Josephus actually said. The other text in Josephus is hardly ever questioned, that mentions Jesus. And then you have Tacitus, who mentions Jesus. That text is rarely questioned. Suetonius may mention Jesus, but it's really difficult to tell. I don't use Suetonius as a source about Jesus because, you know, it's just too difficult to tell. And even if he does, he doesn't say much. You have Lucian mention Jesus around the middle of the second century. He doesn't mention much about him, but he does mention a little about him, that he was crucified in Palestine. You've got Mara Bar Serapion, who mentions him. You have Pliny the Younger, who mentions him. So you do have a few non-Christian sources who mention Jesus. And from those sources, you can get a brief outline of Jesus, one that's pretty compatible with what we read in the New Testament.
Okay, so we're going to triangulate a lot of this stuff, looking at different documentary pieces of evidence here. And I want to start off with the events leading up to Jesus's crucifixion. Now, these might not be as miraculous as the crucifixion itself, so we could possibly have different accounts of, okay, here was the Last Supper, and maybe we even have the menu, I don't know. We could have different documentary sources of the trials, etc. So give us a sense of how do we know about all of the events leading up to the crucifixion, resurrection, including the betrayal of Judas and the trials that involve Caiaphas and Pilate and coming before Herod and all that. How do we know that occurred other than what we have in the biblical text?
Well, the biblical text is going to be our best literature for this. The four Gospels are going to be our most exhaustive sources on the life of Jesus. You'll find a few bits of information peppered throughout the letters of Paul, such as, let's say, 1 Corinthians chapter 11. He talks about some of the things that Jesus said when he administered the Eucharist at the Last Supper. Again, you'll find just a small collection of some data about Jesus in the non-Christian literature, but you're going to find mostly about Jesus in the Gospel, and this is to be expected. You're not going to find much about the Roman world in the Gospels because they're not concerned about it. Their concern is Jesus. And the Roman historians are concerned about Roman history. They're not concerned about Jesus, so we're not going to expect to find much about Jesus in there. So what historians are going to look for in determining things about Jesus, trying to find out about him from history, is they're going to look at certain things like, do we have some multiple independent sources? How early are the sources? Are they corroborated? Some of the stories corroborated by some unsympathetic sources? Are there details that appear to be embarrassing? It's kind of like if a person is filling out an application for an employment, and there's a question on it that says, have you ever been convicted of a felony? And the person answers, yes. Well, the person who is hiring and reading that application would say, I may not know what that felony is, but one thing I know, the person is probably telling the truth here because this embarrassing detail is something that they wouldn't invent on this application. So there's, you know, a historian is going to look for certain elements of a story, say about Jesus, that would have been embarrassing to the early Christians, and then you know, realize that those things are very probably authentic recollections about Jesus and the stories about him.
Yeah, that's a really good observation. You look in the documentary evidence and ask the question, well, why would they say this? And if they have no self-interest in saying this or interest in creating a myth or lying in that regard, you got to say, yeah, that's probably going to be true there.
You know, a lot of people, when they get started, they'll say, well, you know, I don't care about the Bible or what the Bible, the Christian literature says, because they're biased. As though non-Christian literature is not biased, right? They are going to put a great premium on that. Well, yeah, I could understand putting a good premium on the non-Christian literature and what they say about Jesus. But you don't just summarily dismiss the Christian literature any more than you would dismiss a history of the Holocaust written by a Jewish historian or a history of slavery in the United States written by an African-American historian. And say that they're biased. Why would I take a book written by Richard Dawkins, a militant atheist, called The God Delusion, the book called The God Delusion, in which he says, if this book works as I intend, religious readers who pick it up will be atheists when they put it down. You know, you can look at that and say, is Dawkins biased? You bet. Does he have an agenda? You bet. Does that mean his arguments are false? No. You got to look at the integrity of the argument. And it's the same thing with the Christian sources. Are they biased? Yes. Do they have an agenda? Yes. The question is that agenda, was it justified? I mean, if Jesus was who he actually claimed to be, then he's got the greatest message the world could ever receive. And he commanded his followers to go out and share that message with others. So, yes, they would have an agenda in sharing it, but it would be a good agenda. And it wouldn't mean that the message is wrong. So that's why we don't want to, when we look at things, the biblical accounts historically, we don't want to privilege it when we're doing a historical investigation, that is. We don't want to privilege it because it's claimed that the Bible is divinely inspired. We want to look at it historically when we're doing it that way. We want to look at it and say, what is it that we can prove here? And that's when you apply these various criteria of authenticity.
In terms of other sources, so we're looking at authenticity. We're going to read into the scriptures that, okay, they got an agenda. They're telling their side of the story here. We need to look for evidence of veracity in that regard. Are there other sources? And I'm thinking about this in terms of the trials that Jesus went through. Today, court records are highly documented. Were they back at that time? Is there some evidence that Pilate kept a record or a diary of something, and we have found that and say, okay, yeah, it seems like the story that they told here about the trials seems to correspond to what we have in the judicial records?
There is a piece of literature later on called the Acts of Pilate, but almost all scholars regard it as spurious. It's fake. Did Pilate keep legal records? Perhaps, probably, but they perished. It's not only just the trial of Jesus that we no longer have. We don't have any trials conducted by Pilate that have survived. So, no, we don't have any other legal reports of Jesus' trial outside the gospel.
Okay, so that's what we're relying upon there. And the next thing I want to move to then is the actual crucifixion. What kind of evidence do we have there? Are we relying mostly upon the Gospels here? Are we looking at certain things? Well, why would Matthew say this or somebody else say that? What is the convincing evidence here for the events of the crucifixion?
Well, you do have all four Gospels, and most scholars would at least admit that Mark and John are independent sources. And most commentators, scholars who have written commentaries on Mark would say, and those who have written New Testament introductions would say that Mark got his information from the Apostle Peter. And most scholars on John would say that the Gospel of John, if it wasn't written by John, certainly relied on, source material that did come from at least one of Jesus's original disciples. So there's a lot of skepticism on who wrote the Gospel of John, but the majority of scholars, even the skeptical ones, would say it is based on eyewitness testimony from one of Jesus' disciples. So you have multiple independent sources there that would be, you know, traced back to Peter and one of Jesus' disciples. Earlier than that, you have Paul, who mentions Jesus' crucifixion. So that's another source, and it's a very early source. In addition, he mentions Jesus' death. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 3 through 7, in what is virtually unanimously agreed upon by scholars as an early oral tradition, a creed, and that this thing goes back, this creed goes back very early and is probably linked to the Jerusalem apostles, those who had known Jesus. So you do have eyewitness testimony of Jesus' crucifixion that's very early, multiple independent sources. You have unsympathetic sources like Josephus and Tacitus and Lucian, who mention Jesus's either his execution by the Romans or, more specifically, his crucifixion. You've got the fact that the chances of surviving crucifixion are very low. We only have one account of a person surviving crucifixion in antiquity. It's reported by Josephus. When he saw three of his friends crucified, and so he went to his friend, the Roman commander Titus, and asked a favor to spare his friends. And as a favor to Josephus, Titus ordered that all three be removed from their crosses and provided the best medical care Rome had to offer. In spite of that, two of the three still died. But that is the only account of a person surviving crucifixion in antiquity. So we have no evidence that Jesus was removed from his cross intentionally while alive, or that he was provided any medical care whatsoever, much less Rome's death. So we can always look at possibilities, but historians are required to go with probabilities. And given all the evidence we have for Jesus' death by crucifixion, the sensible historian, at least, must conclude that Jesus was crucified and that the process killed him.
Okay, that seems very historically plausible. I mean, it was a common method of execution back then. We have the unsympathetic outside sources saying, yep, this is happening. It's going to be very difficult. But here's the meat of the matter that we want to get to here, and that's the issue of the resurrection. Now, that seems to be an account that really needs to be taken on faith. So the other stuff, there's going to be trials. There's going to be a crucifixion. Okay. Corroborating evidence seems all plausible. But this one, it's going to be a little bit tougher. So what kind of empirical evidence can we look for in order to verify the accounts of something that is miraculous, that doesn't happen every day? In fact, that only happened once.
Yeah. Well, interesting enough, we have almost the same amount of evidence for the resurrection of Jesus as we do the crucifixion. And so you'll have atheists and agnostic historians say that Jesus' death by crucifixion is one of the most certain facts of the ancient world. And again, we have almost the same amount of evidence for his resurrection as we do for the crucifixion. So the problem with the resurrection isn't a lack of evidence. It is the miraculous nature of it. So that is, I think, what needs to be dealt with. Can we, as historians, verify historical claims? My answer to that, in short, and you know, we can unpack it further if you want. My answer, in short, would be: if an event occurred in the past, in principle at least, we should be able to investigate it and adjudicate on whether the event occurred. There might be a paucity of data. There might be other challenges involved, but if it's a miraculous event, it shouldn't be much different than if, you know, report of a miraculous event, it shouldn't be much different than if it was a non-miraculous event. The difference would be the cause. Now, I could look at it and say, I can verify that the event occurred, but as a historian, I may not be able to identify the cause of the event. And that happens a lot anyway among historians. There are numerous events that they can determine that the event actually occurred, but they are unable to determine what the cause was. And we could probably do that when it comes to a miraculous event as well. We can determine that the event occurred without determining the cause of the event. We could leave that as a question mark.
So let's go ahead and unpack this, as you said. And the way I want to go about doing this, and you do it very well in your book, is to deal with alternative hypotheses and then knock them down. This is the classic scientific method that I might not be able to prove the cause definitively, but I can prove that other causes are not the cause definitively. So let's go ahead and do that. You discuss in your books a variety of myths surrounding the resurrection. So let's go ahead and visit some of those. Let's start off with one of the arguments that's made that, okay, this can't be true. This resurrection story can't be true because there's contradictions in the Gospels.
Well, that's a fun one to deal with because this has been an area of research of mine for the past 7.5 years. And in fact, I have a book coming out on it this fall, published by Oxford University Press. Why are there differences in the Gospels? Gosh, there's so much I could say about it. Let's just put it, let's see if I can put this in a nutshell. Number one, you have a lot of different accounts, whether it's the assassination of Caesar or what happened in December of 50 and January of 49 BC that led to Caesar's crossing the Rubicon, or the Catilinarian conspiracy of the fall of 63 BC, and winter of 62 BC, what happened in those? There are all sorts of discrepancies between the different accounts. And yet no one's going to turn around and say Caesar wasn't assassinated. The Catilinarian conspiracy never occurred. They're not going to question these things. They're just going to say, well, some of the peripheral details were wrong, but it doesn't call into question the bottom line or the gist of what actually occurred. It's kind of like the thinking of the Titanic. There were actually eyewitnesses, survivors, who ended up saying that Titanic broke in two prior to sinking, while others said, no, it went down intact. Well, how do you get that wrong? You're out in the middle of the ocean. It's really the only thing you can see at night. It's all lit up. There's screams coming from it. It's a little over 800 feet long. It's an emotionally intense night for you. How do you get that wrong? Some saying it broke into two before sinking. It says, no, I saw it too. It went down intact. I don't know, but no one turns around and says, well, I guess the Titanic didn't sink. They just say that there were some details that some people got wrong. So let's say that the discrepancies amongst the gospel accounts, let's say that there was no way of explaining them other than to say that a bunch of the peripheral details are wrong. And by the way, all the discrepancies are in the peripheral details. No one questions that the tomb was empty. No one questions that Jesus died. No one questions that he was crucified. No one questions, or what I'm saying is, the reports all say he was crucified. The reports all said he died. The reports all said the tomb was empty. The reports all said that he appeared alive to them afterward. You could debate over whether there was one or two angels at the tomb, or the time of the day in which Jesus was crucified, and who went to the tomb, and whether both thieves cursed him or one repented. But the main details are not in dispute. They're in harmony. So another thing I would add, and I think that this is really important, is ancient biography was a flexible genre, and there were various compositional devices and ways of paraphrasing that were either taught or we can infer by the ancient literature. And we find these compositional devices being used by virtually all the ancient historians and biographers. And when we read the Gospels in light of their ancient biographical genre, and we read them in view of these compositional devices and techniques for paraphrasing, almost all of the gospel discrepancies just melt away. So I really don't think that this is a problem at all. And I would say within a few years, it probably isn't going to be something that skeptics can cite as a reason for rejecting the gospel accounts.
Okay, so how about another one? Let me come at you at another way to say, and let me play the skeptic here, that, you know, all this is just a retelling of a pagan myth. I mean, we have these stories of resurrection from the dead in all sorts of places, and, you know, it's just a fairy tale. And I'm sure that, yeah, all of this stuff, the death happened, crucifixion happened, but, you know, a bunch of the disciples got together and say, hey, let's just borrow this story from ye old pagans.
Yeah, that's a fun one as well. First, I'd like to point out that there are virtually no practicing historians today who take such a position. That position was very popular about 100 years ago when James Frazier came out with his book, The Golden Bough, in 1906. But in 1933, you had Roland DeVue, who refuted it. 1968, you had Gunther Wagner, 1987, Jonathan Smith, 1998, you had Mark Smith, 2001, T.M.D. Mettinger, and these are just the major figures. Other wrote on as well. By the time Mettinger wrote in 2001 in a book titled The Riddle of Resurrection, he's a senior Swedish scholar, and he posited that there were probably three and as many as five dying and rising gods in the literature that predate Christianity. But he admitted, he's a very good scholar, and he did a very careful job, and he didn't go beyond what the evidence could bear, in my opinion. And he was very careful and honest at points to say, you know, I might be wrong at this, this is how I interpret this particular thing here, but it may be interpreted in a different way, and that would eliminate my example here. And at the end, he says, look, these three to five that I've presented are so different than the Christian account that it's very unlikely that Christians would have copied from them. And he goes on and he says, moreover, these three to five figures appear way back in the gray, distant past, whereas the Christians were reporting that Jesus had died and rose within their lifetime. And it seems very suggestive that they actually believed what they were claiming, that Jesus had rose, leaving behind an empty tomb, and had appeared to them. And this is far different than these other figures, all of whom were tied to the agricultural cycles, and like the story of Baal and all these others. So it's kind of like in the summer you have drought, and then you have the fall rain. And it brings life, and it brings life to the agriculture. And so they would use these myths of dying and rising gods, like Baal, who is the storm god. He's the god of the rain and the wind and the lightning, and his brother eats him in the underworld. And so the mother goes and instructs her son, Mot, to vomit his brother Baal, and then she leaves. And then later on, the father says, oh, I guess Mot did that, and Baal is alive again. Well, why? Because he saw rain. Therefore, Baal must have been alive, because Baal had to be alive in order for it to rain. So it's very similar to the kind of myth that, like, my mom, your mom, other people's parents would tell him when we were little children, and we said, what is thunder? And they'd say, well, it's the angels bowling in heaven. And so that's what that kind of stuff was. The Christian account, on the other hand, was something that the early Christians really believed and presented as actually having occurred. It wasn't a myth. So that's just one answer. Let me give you a couple more, though. I think when you look at these dying and rising gods, and there aren't many at all that predate Jesus, the ones that are there are very different, but there aren't many at all. Most of them that we read about come after Jesus. So if anybody's copying off of anyone, it might be them copying off of a Christian. When they cite parallels to Jesus, you can find parallels in just about anything. So, Tony, I'd say most of us are aware of a plane that took off from Massachusetts just after 9 o'clock one morning, and just after 10, it flew into one of the tallest skyscrapers in New York City between the 78th and 80th floors, killing everybody on board. You know what I'm talking about, right?
I think that might be September 11th. Yeah.
Well, no.
No.
It's actually when the B-25 flew into the Empire State Building on July 28th, 1945.
Aha.
And that really occurred. If you do a search for it, you can even see pictures of the aftermath. Most people don't know about it, but it actually flew into the same floor as the 767 that flew into the South Tower on 9/11. Well, we wouldn't turn around and say, well, 9/11 probably didn't happen. And you can come up with all sorts of modern mythologizing here. You could say, well, maybe 1,000 years from now, a historian will say that 9/11 never happened. Why? Well, because it was just copying off of the B-25 flying into the Empire State Building. That is suggestive by the actual date in which it happened. What, 9/11? Well, who do you call when you have an emergency? 911. What was the emergency? Well, we had an economic crisis in the United States at that point, the worst recession in American history up to that point, and that was symbolized by the collapse of the World Trade Center building. We also had declining influence of the American government around the world. That was symbolized by the plane flying into the Pentagon. And also the fact that this reached and impacted the average American was symbolized by the plane crashing into the Pennsylvania farm field. So see, you can make up and do this modern mythologizing in 1,000 years. Now that might sound pretty good. But it's completely invented. It's completely false. It's completely coincidental. What you have to be able to show, if you're going to say that the Christians copied off of these others, is you have to be able to make a very firm connection. And skeptics haven't been able to do that. I'm just giving you two reasons. I could give you four more, but probably don't want to spend the time on that. Yeah. But it's for these reasons and others that the majority, almost 100% of all scholars who study the subject have rejected the hypothesis that the Christians borrowed from pagan religions.
One of the things you mentioned early in discussing this is that it's not linked to the agricultural cycle. And I want you to discuss that a little bit, because I hear a lot of skeptics of the resurrection saying, well, this is just, the risen, it's springtime, and that's why we have the eggs, it's a new birth, and the bunny rabbits, because bunny rabbits, appear in the early spring. How would you address the critique that, well, this is just an agricultural thing?
Well, I would say that, number one, you would have to show that there's a connection there, that there are all sorts of similarities, as I mentioned with 911 and the B-25. I could name some others as well, many others, not just 9/11, but other stories in which there are many similarities. I'll just give you another one here. We're aware of a boat that was sailing across the Atlantic about 100 years ago. It was regarded as unsinkable, and it was going a little too fast one April evening, and it hit an iceberg, and the unsinkable happened. It sank, and more than half of its passengers perished in the process. The name of that boat, let's see, it started with a T. It was the Ty, the Titan, the Titan, and that's the story in a fiction, in a novel, titled Futility, The Wreck of the Titan, and it was written in 1898, 14 years prior to the sinking of the Titanic. And yet all of those details are true in that book. I've got the book on my shelf. But it doesn't mean the Titanic didn't sink. So when you are talking about a rich record of history, of all these events, all these stories, you are always going to be able to find some kind of details that you can recognize as parallels that are interesting. I've been able to draw a number of parallels between Jesus feeding the 5,000, Jesus and his disciples, and Walt Kowalski in the movie Gran Torino. they say, well, how are you going to draw a similarities between Jesus and Walt Wolfsky in that movie? Well, there's some really striking parallels that you can see. Now, that doesn't take into difference to even more striking differences. But you have to be able to show those things. I would also say that we can show that the original disciples, the original Christians, actually believed that Jesus had been raised from the dead and had appeared to them. And because of that, you won't find scholars today saying that Jesus' resurrection was just simply a legend that developed over time, or that it was a myth that developed over time. These original followers of Jesus actually believed that he rose and appeared to them.
So that hits another one of the myths that you address, is the legend that this develops over time, but it relates to another myth or conceptualization, or I should say critique of the skeptics, is that what if this is a big fraud? It's a conspiracy theory that, you know, you're putting a lot of your emphasis on this person who's claiming to be the Son of God, and you want to make sure that the story is all good. So the crucifixion occurs, and then you all huddle together and say, hey, you know what, let's craft this story, and everybody got their details good. We'll just, somebody sneak in late at night, and we'll take out the body, and we'll make it look really good. How would you answer that?
I'd say that seems plausible right off, but here we look at what we call explanatory power when assessing a hypothesis. Explanatory power, there's a number of ways of describing it, but one popular way would be to say, given the truth of that hypothesis, we would expect certain things. Is what we expect what we get? If it's not what we get, then it lacks explanatory power. If it is what we get, then it has good explanatory power. So let's look at this for a second, the fraud hypothesis. The disciples huddle together and they say, let's make up this story, let's get our facts straight, and let's go out and proclaim that Jesus has risen from the dead, and that way we don't look so stupid for following a false prophet, a false messiah. Well, in that case, under the persecution from the Jews and the Romans that we know that these guys got, because we have at least 11 ancient sources that report that these guys were persecuted and that they were willing to die for their gospel proclamations about Jesus' death and resurrection and that he was the Messiah. Would we expect that they would all die or they would all endure suffering and be willing to die for a known lie? We wouldn't expect that. What about his Jesus' brother James? Because of the criterion of embarrassment, most scholars who write on the subject acknowledge that James was a non-believer up through the time of Jesus' crucifixion. I mean, even the Gospels say none of Jesus' brothers believed in him, or they thought he was beside himself. So, but afterward, in the book of Acts, and in Paul's letters, and in the letter of James and Jude, we find Jesus' brothers as now believers, and James as a leader in the Jerusalem church, and through Josephus, Clement of Alexandria, and Hegesippus, we find that James died as a martyr. He was martyred, killed by the Jewish leadership, because he would not deny his brother Jesus as the Messiah. What would impact and cause such a transformation of belief from James, who was a skeptic and not believing in his brother, to now all of a sudden being so convinced that his brother's the Messiah and Lord that he's willing to die as a martyr for him? What about Paul, who was out persecuting the church and arresting and imprisoning and executing Christians because he thought that that was a Jewish cult, that it was God's will for him to destroy? And all of a sudden he converts to Christianity because he has this experience that convinces him that Jesus had been raised and had appeared to them, him, and he's willing to die for his beliefs, and is martyred for his beliefs. Now, explanatory power. If they all huddled, do we expect them to all be willing to die and suffer continuously for what they know is a lie? No, we don't expect that. Do we expect James, the skeptical brother of Jesus, and Paul, who's persecuting the church, to convert because they think Jesus rose from the dead and they actually experienced him risen from the dead? No, we don't expect those things. So the fraud hypothesis lacks explanatory power. the resurrection hypothesis, though, if Jesus actually was raised, do we expect the disciples now to go proclaiming boldly that he had been raised? Yes. Would it surprise us at all that his brother, who was a skeptic up to his death, now can becomes a follower and dies as a martyr? Yes, we would expect something like that. Would we expect Paul, the persecutor of the church, to convert? Yes. That shouldn't surprise us at all. So the resurrection hypothesis has wonderful explanatory power. So in that sense, it's far superior to the fraud hypothesis.
There's another explanation. You cover a number of these in your books. We won't have the time to go through all of them, so we will turn people back to your books to go through all these. And it's a great point-by-point discussion that you have here. One of the other ones that intrigued me was this issue that has been, you know, popular as of late, and actually has been popular for a long time, is this idea of the lost gospels, which tell the real story. How would you address the issue of the lost gospels?
Well, at first I'd point out and say that even an expert on the lost gospels, and that's Bart Ehrman, he's a friend of mine. He's an agnostic New Testament scholar who teaches at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And he's written on the lost gospels. He's considered an expert on them. And in his New Testament introduction, he makes a statement that he says that these lost gospels, this non-canonical Christian literature, tells us more about what some Christians thought about Jesus in the second and third centuries. But if we want to know about the real Jesus from the first century, he says there's only one place to go, and that's the New Testament Gospels. And he says, and I quote him on this, "This is not for theological reasons, it is for historical reasons, pure and simple." So that's an agnostic expert on these lost gospels who is making the statement. And there's good reason for him to make this statement. When you look at these lost gospels and you actually go to reading them, which many people who want to appeal to them never even read them, you start to read them and you understand immediately why people don't give these things serious thought. Jesus is as a child, and by the way, the reason the Gospels don't mention Jesus much as a child, was that's just standard for ancient biographies. Ancient biographies mostly talked about the person's lineage and then jumped right into the inauguration of the person's public life. So that's why they don't mention much about Jesus' childhood. But some of these lost Gospels focus on stories about Jesus' childhood, and will make up things like Jesus is working with his dad as a carpenter, and his dad cuts a bean too short. He's really worried because now he's not going to make any profit after doing all the work. And Jesus says, "Hey, Pop, no problem." And he goes over and he stretches the bean to its proper length. Or on another occasion, some kids are mocking him, and so he just curses them, and they wither up and die on the spot. And they scold Jesus for doing this. So you have some stories like this, and you understand why like the Gospel of Philip has been appealed to say that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene. But when you look at the Gospel of Philip, he's not married. He's not married to her. This is after the resurrection. It's talking about Mary, the sister of Philip. It doesn't even say she's Mary Magdalene. And she's going around telling Christians, converts, that when you convert, you have to be single, and even if you're single, you can't get if you're married, you have to get divorced and live a celibate life. And these are precisely the opposite teachings that Jesus had. Like in the Sermon on the Mount, he says, whoever divorces his wife except for the cause of immorality makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. And Jesus didn't permit divorce except if there was sexual unfaithfulness within the marriage. So you got to say, well, gosh, if that's Mary Magdalene there and she's telling people if they're married, they got to get divorced and you can't have sex. I mean, what's it saying about Jesus as her husband? Must not have been a good marriage. So there's all kinds of weird things in these non-canonical gospels. And most scholars date them to the second and third centuries. And I don't know of any who would attribute them to the people the titles attributed them to. Like, I don't think anyone thinks Thomas wrote the Gospel of Thomas, or that Peter wrote the Gospel of Peter, or that Philip wrote the Gospel of Philip, or that Mary wrote the Gospel of Mary, or any of those things. You know, these are just universally rejected by even skeptical scholars as being written by those they're attributed to.
Okay. Let me toss out one other one. It relates to one of the things that you addressed directly, which is mass hallucinations. But here's one that I often hear is that, well, you know, what really went on was that, you know, Jesus was crucified. He was put into the tomb. A big rock was rolled in front of it. But then there were some pranksters that came along. You know, they is hearing that Jesus is this really big deal. Let's go ahead and play a joke on everybody. We'll sneak in. We'll take the body out of the tomb. And then when that happens, all the believers come by and say, whoa, something really big happened. That's what Jesus said was going to happen. And they end up talking themselves into believing all of this, much the way that a mass hallucination could occur. And the other question I have related to this too, and I've always been somewhat curious about this, is that why would anybody go back and check the tomb to see if they're there? Usually when, you know, we bury grandma or something, we put grandma in the ground and say, grandma's going to be there. I'm not going to go check in a few days. So clue us in on that. Do you think this was pranksters? Do you think they were able to fool people into believing this, and that the story spiraled from there?
Well, in terms of the second question, why would they have even gone back to visit the tomb? If the gospel accounts are correct, then Jesus is removed around 3 o'clock, and there's a hasty burial to try to get him buried properly before sunset. And this would be would be compatible with what we read from Josephus. Typically, crucified victims throughout the Roman Empire were left on their crosses for days. It would be days before they died, and then even after they died, they were left on their crosses for a while for scavengers, dogs, insects, birds to come feed off the carcasses. And then they were removed and thrown into a common pit and given a burial in that way, a dishonorable burial. But Josephus reports in his Jewish War, Book 4, Section 317, he says that in Jerusalem it was an exception, because prior to the fall of Jerusalem, it was the custom of the Jews to remove the crucified from their crosses and give them a proper burial prior to sunset. So the Romans, up until a couple years prior to the fall of Jerusalem, allowed the Jews in Jerusalem to do this. So if Jesus dies around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, he's got to be buried that same day. So it makes sense to break their legs to hasten the death of the crucified victims in Jerusalem. So that gives plausibility to the crucifixion narratives, the passion narratives in the Gospels. Jesus is already dead. They remove him from the cross. They try to give him a hasty burial, get him there buried before sunset. So according to the Gospels, they're going to go back on Sunday morning, the women, in order to finish anointing his body for burial with the spices. So that would give you a reason why they went back. In terms of the pranksters, of course, you have to deal with Paul, because an empty tomb would be a prankster, a stolen body, deceit would be the first thing that the Apostle Paul, when he was a skeptic and persecuting the church and heard about resurrection, that would have been the first thing he would have suspected. Fraud, lies, deceit. But he converted because he said he actually saw the risen Jesus. So even if it weren't the disciples that did it, and it was a prankster who removed the body, that would not have been nearly enough to convince Paul. So the prankster hypothesis doesn't account adequately for Paul. In terms of the hallucinations, what we know about hallucinations doesn't seem to be in line with or compatible with the prankster hypothesis. Hallucinations, not everybody hallucinates, because they have different personalities. Some people are more subject to hallucinations than others. Even the group most likely to experience a hallucination, we have found, are senior adults bereaving the loss of a loved one, and yet only 7% of them experience a visual hallucination of their loved one. With the disciples, you have 100% of them. He appeared to the 12. He appeared to all the apostles. So it's not the maximum that we read is 7%. It's an unthinkable 100%. We also know that hallucinations are not group occurrences because hallucinations exist. They're phenomena that exist in the mind of an individual. They have no external reality. So they're very much like dreams in that way. A dream has no external reality. I could not have a dream that I'm in Hawaii, wake up for a moment, and then wake up my wife and say, hey, go back to sleep, join me in my dream, and let's have a free vacation. She can't join me in my dream because it doesn't have an external reality. It's in my mind. And it's the same thing with a hallucination. Hallucinations are different than illusions. They're different than delusions. A hallucination is a false sensory perception. And so even if they were having a hallucination, not 100% are going to have them. You're not going to have group hallucinations, and yet we see several group appearances of the risen Jesus to others. And then, again, Paul, you're not going to think that he's going to have a hallucination because he's not grieving over Jesus' death. He's glad Jesus is dead, and now he's trying to destroy the church Jesus started. Jesus would have been the last person in the universe that Paul would have expected to see or wanted to see. So the hallucination hypothesis, even when combined with the fraud hypothesis, the prankster hypothesis, it just doesn't do a good job at all of explaining the facts. In fact, it's one of the weakest hypotheses out there.
Yeah, that is consistent with what you're talking about, the explanatory hypothesis. And again, the way you go about this to set up the different explanations and then say, okay, relative to the gospel and what it says, how good are these explanations? You do that extremely well in your books, and you cover many other points, and we'll point folks back to your various books and on this. You cover a lot more things, including looking at the veracity of Paul's conversion, and folks would really enjoy reading this, so we'll send them back to that. But in the time that we have remaining here, in the last few minutes, I always like to ask a question of my guest, and that is, how has the study of this topic affected you spiritually, personally, intellectually? Because studying something, doing research, is not just asking a question and finding an answer. It's actually a journey that has a very transformative impact on many other individuals. Did it have a transformative impact on you looking at all of this? And if so, how?
Good question. Transformative. Did it have a transformative effect on me? I would say no, it didn't. I had already been a believer. I'd already believed that Jesus had been raised from the dead before my long investigation. Now, during that investigation, I was willing to give up my faith, and there were a couple times when I almost did, because I was working very hard to be as objective as possible. And nobody can be completely objective. Nobody can. Even Bart Ehrman will admit that he's biased. And one thing upon which almost all philosophers of history will agree on is that nobody is a completely objective, neutral historian. And I make no claims that I got there. I can say that I worked hard toward that goal, and I felt that there were occasions when I was entirely neutral. But I found that you have to make deliberate and consistent effort to remain there. And you just can't remain there all the time because of the conditioning that you have from childhood or your education or your own desires. But you have to really work at being objective. It's a difficult task. But I would say that my idiosyncrasy, one of my idiosyncrasies, is that I'm a second guesser. And I second guess my faith. I second guess everything, not just my faith, but everything, even little things in my life that are insignificant. And it's very frustrating, to be honest with you, Tony. Most idiosyncrasies are frustrating to the person having them, as well as others around them. And I can tell you my wife gets frustrated with me at times because of this. But I can say that my studies of the resurrection like this, when I did get to the end, and one of the reasons I tried to be as objective as possible is because I had wanted for this to help resolve some of the doubts that plagued me for years. Did it do away with all of them? No. I will struggle with doubts for the rest of my life, and I'll do it off and on. Sometimes it'll be more intense than others. It's not usually due to a lack of evidence. It's due to things such as, come on, I mean, this story is just too good to be true. God really loves me? That's the kind of doubts that I will have. It's not because of a lack of evidence or because the evidence we have is poor. But it has helped me some with my doubts. In fact, it's helped me significantly with my doubts. To know that I've gone through this and did my investigation with integrity, it has helped me in that way. But I wouldn't say it's transformed my life, because I think my life was transformed by Jesus before I went into this historical investigation.
Very interesting observations there. And for those folks who might be like the rest of us and have doubts, the books that you have written really are a wonderful explanation of things that we oftentimes take on faith, and it's a great way of solidifying our faith. So we will point folks back to your books. My guest today has been Michael Lacona. Mike, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.